The west of Ireland has a long but mostly forgotten tradition of harvesting sea salt. It's an industry which goes back hundreds of years, but died out in the late 1800s. Now it's undergoing a revival on Achill Island. Joanna McNicholas went along to the Achill Island Sea Salt Company for seascapes.
In times past, seawater was collected and used to produce sea salt. And in Achill Island, off the west coast of Ireland, the O'Malley family have revived this ancient practice at their sea salt factory.
I'm Marjorie O'Malley, and I'm a co-founder of Achill Island Sea Salt, a family business based here on Achill Island. And we started in 2013 in our kitchen, and we were inspired by a programme on sea salt production in Wales, where they also began in their family kitchen. And we also discovered that sea salt was produced on the island up to the 1820s. In 2013, we approached the local enterprise office and they gave us a mentor who suggested we maybe try it out in the local market and make it at home, which we did. And it has grown from there.
And who's involved in the business with you here?
At this point in time, it's myself, my husband, and our daughter, Maeve, and Sean, my son. He was very involved in the beginning, but he's not with us at this point in time. And our other son helped with packing and while he was a student. So officially, there's three of us at the moment. And then we have another lady who packs on a part-time basis and another gentleman who helps us with the production. And we also have a gentleman who collects the water for us. So I guess there's six really at the minute.
And how do you collect the seawater?
We began in 2013 collecting the water with buckets from the shore in Kiel. And that was very messy and very time consuming. And as we found the business growing and the demand growing, we moved out of the kitchen into a porter cabin beside the house to trial the business, and we invested in a small tankard and we used that to collect the water, again using buckets and pouring it into it. And obviously that's not sustainable, so we now have a large tanker which takes 6,000 litres and it's towed by a tractor to the Valley Pier. So we bring the water then to a holding tank outside the factory and we pump it from there into what's known as an IBC, where it's filtered for anything that's suspended like seaweed or sand. And it's pumped into an evaporator, which is a sealed container. So the water is pumped in from the outside tank into this IBC, and then it's pumped up through that pipe all the way over to this tank, and it's reduced here in this. It's like a pressure cooker, and when it's ready, it's pumped then up into the ceiling and then into the bath inside in the crystallizing room. So this is our crystallizing room, where the crystals form in this vat, which is probably the most interesting point in the entire process because they grow together into perfect cylinders. So they're pyramid in shape. And also inside here, the salt is dried, or the crystals are dried, and then they're packed. And this is it's a clean room, so you have to be gowned up to go in there.
How long does it take from the time you put the water into this IBC right through until you have the flakes?
It could take anything from 40 to 50 hours, and it's very labour intensive.
Old maps from the 1700s and 1800s clearly show salt production took place in Achill.
And indeed there was salt produced all around Clubay, and the entire coast. We had to have salt, we couldn't preserve our food, especially fish. And a lot of salt would have been originally desalinated in large rock pools by the sunlight, and it would have taken a lot longer, and then they would have taken the crystals and finished them over turf fires. The Chinese made salt 6,000 years ago and taxed it. Roman soldiers were paid in salt. That's where the word salary comes from. Or you weren't worth your salt, weight in salt, or slaves were often traded for salt. And a lot of places in Europe would have grown up around salt, like Salzburg. There was a lake in the mountains and the animals found that lake and the town built up around it. So even down around the coast here, a lot of names would have been after salt. Salt Hill, Chock and Thallon, Salty Islands, you know, which was part of our culture. Perhaps it died with the famine when they couldn't make food, they didn't make salt. But also in the 1800s, with the Industrial Revolution, they learned how to take today's processed salt out of the ground. And that, together with a repeal of a tax on salt in the UK, was really the demise of the salt industry in Ireland, because we had a lot more imported salt and the industry couldn't survive. So salt was a huge part of Great Britain at the time, their funding. There was so much tax collected from salt makers, and they restricted the times you could collect salt. You could only do it at certain times of the day, and indeed there were sheriffs policing the manufacture of salt. So there was a lobby group, I guess, to repeal it, to compete with European salt. But, you know, the effect in Ireland was the demise of the industry.
And what's the difference between sea salt and the ordinary salt that we buy?
Well, all salt comes from an ocean, whether it's from the sea where we collect it or a dried up ocean millions of years ago. The processed or commercial salt has only sodium chloride. A lot of the minerals that are in sea salt are gone. And they also add anti-caking agent to make it free flow through the salt cellar, and they spray it with iodine. But sea salt is naturally mineralised. Our sea salt has over 40 trace elements in it, and they're maintained because of our slow process. And they're there for, like salt made maybe 10 miles down the coast could be different to our salt. A subtle difference, but a difference all the same. And our salt has, because there's cliffs on the island, you're having fresh water rolling over those cliffs, rolling over the stones, gathering minerals from the rocks and joining the sea. And then obviously the seabed has its own unique fish debris and so on. And all of that is forming a different type of salt than you would get, I suppose, just down the coast. And it's all mixed together. So it's very high in minerals. And it's also quite sweet, which I know sounds a bit of an irony, but that's what they tell us. There's a sweet taste to it. And it's our process is very gentle. The chefs liked the fact that the salt was flaky, so we kept to that process because they validated it from the very beginning.
So can you show us some of your products now that you have developed here?
So we're in the shop here at the moment. We renovated this factory. It's a new De Ros factory, so when we moved out of our Porta cabin, this is where we moved to. And while we were here, we had a number of people knocking the door and asked to see the process. So we decided to open a little visitor centre. And so in the visitor centre, we show you around. But we also have this little gift shop, which has our product in it. Like, for example, we have chocolates from Proper Chocolate and New Chocolate, and they would have our salt in them. Biscuits from Lismore, and they use our salt. We have a caramel sauce from Northern Ireland, beautiful, and she's won a great taste, and a Blossom Aheron, and she uses our salt in her caramel sauce. And crisps, Joe Farm crisps from Cork, they're vegetable crisps, so they have partnered with us as well. We have our ordinary plain salt, and last year we decided to smoke the salt. So we smoke it in cars in Killala. There's a smoky aroma from it if you smell it, and also it gives that barbecued effect to meat, vegetables and so on. And this month we introduced another salt, a seaweed salt, which is from, the seaweed is from Connemara Seaweed Company. And it's an Atlantic wakame, or also known as an Alaria escalente. And that seaweed salt is really nice over stir fries, rice, and roast potatoes and other roast vegetables. This gives that additional savoury, and obviously it's got nutrition in it. So that's our products. We distribute directly here. We have a courier. We also distribute through Tony Kenny from Bia Foods. He does the super values for us in the west of Ireland and down from Donegal to, I think he does as far as Limerick. We are with Sheridan's, the cheese company, and they distribute to the artisan shops they operate with, as well as to the concession shops in Dunn stores. And we distribute through another company, Taste the View, and our biggest customer with them is the Cliffs of Moher.
Family member Maeve O'Malley has an important role in the business.
My main role is marketing and sales, but today I'm labelling our jars of salt. So all the jars are hand labelled, so it'll take me a couple of hours. But other than that, I kind of work on the marketing side, our social media and our website, and then just trying to generate new sales. Did my undergraduate degree in microbiology, but I felt science wasn't really for me. So luckily I had a sea salt business to come back to. So I worked here for a year, and then I decided to do a master's in UCC in food business. So I just finished that last year. So hopefully I'll just continue to work in the food industry now.
Marjorie O'Malley thinks the oceans have a lot to offer.
We believe that, like, while the sea has been the lifeblood of the people in Achill for generations, it has a lot more to offer than just fishing. There's so much in that, in our tides, that could be channeled into different areas if the will was there to do it. The best part for us has been the support we've had locally. They kind of identify it as their product, you know, and it's that it's from the island, and there's great pride of place associated with it. That really, to me, has been the most satisfying. And that we're still here after 6 years is also satisfying.
Joanna McNicholas on Achill Island. January has traditionally been the time when people look out from the dark evenings and start planning and dreaming of their summer holidays. This year, you might consider spending some time on our vastly underutilised inland waterways and explore the country through our rivers and lakes. Corkman Gerald O'Flynn is an avid navigator of the inland waterways. I met him recently at his home, and he told me of his travels, and he had many recommendations.
I've been all over. Every summer I go either west and up the Limerick estuary, or I go east and go in through past Dunmore East and on up to St Mullins is where you start on the Barrow navigation. And from there then I carry on up to the Grand Canal. If I'm going from the east, I go across the Grand Canal as far as Shannon Harbour, and then take a right-hand turn and go off up through Athlone, Loughree. I have gone twice from Leitrim across the Urn Canalway into Lough Urn, and from there right up to Enniskillen, and as far as you can go west then is Beleek, which I've been to, and that's only something like 3 miles from Donegal Bay, so that you can cover, you know, the whole of Ireland on the waterways. You could come back down then, and I go maybe into Loch Allen and come out of that and go back down and go out from Killaloe down through the through Ardnacocha and out through Limerick and home around by way of Dingle, Fianna. We can't pass those on the way back. And, you know, you can be as leisurely as you like, or if you're in a hurry, well, then you steam on. The inland waterways are very different in that if you take the Shannon, right, you go around and you go in at Ardnacocha, and you have a 97-foot rise there in two locks, which is quite an experience.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it until you travel it, you don't actually realise the massive engineering feat that was. From that to the top of the Shannon, you actually only have five locks once you're in Ardnacocha. And there's I think the maximum rise is between 120 and 140 feet is all the fall is on the entire Shannon. Whereas if you go east along round and go in by Hook Head and up past Dunmore East, Passage West, you can take a turn off to the left and go up to Waterford City, which has magnificent mooring facilities and that there. And you can do the shore up as far as Carrigan Shore, which I have done also.
The River Barrow is a favourite of yours.
Oh yes, the River Barrow is a favourite of mine because, well, you have a lot more interest there. You're travelling a lot slower because in all, until you join it with the Grand Canal, I think there's 35 or 36 locks you have, whereas you have only 5 on the Shannon.
Okay.
And these locks are all manhandled. They have to be worked by hand, whereas the ones on the Shannon are all automatic, are worked by keepers, but they're all worked by hydraulic rams and things like that.
You know, you've gone, you told me, 7 out of the last 8 years through our inland waterways. What do they have to recommend them?
Well, I mean, they have such a variation of countryside. You know, when you start on the Barrow, you're actually almost in a steep fjord going up with trees coming down both sides of you. Now and again, you'd have a glimpse of the green fields coming down, maybe with 3 or 4 houses built specially to get the view on a particular twist of the river. It's very, very twisty up as far as St Mullins. And then you get to St Mullins and once you're into the first lock at St Mullins, you're then into what is known as the Barrow Navigation. The boat I have is called a Rhea 850. She's essentially, I suppose, she's a deep sea angling boat with accommodation. You can sleep 4 people at a tight squeeze. But she has a big engine, so she can travel anything up to 23 or 4 knots if you need to. But then when she's traveling on the waterways, she just puts along at about 4 kilometres an hour. She's barely ticking over at that.
Do you meet many people along the way? We get the impression, and we are told, that the inland waterways are very underutilised.
Well, and the Barrow is very, very underutilised. I normally go there about the 3rd week in May, and I'd stay on it for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And if I would pass 4 or 5 boats in the full length of that 86 kilometres, it's as much.
We have here in front of us books on the waterways, the Inland Waterways of Ireland by Jane Cumberledge. How well charted are all these waterways?
Well, now that book is actually only, if you like, giving you the overall picture. But the Inland Waterways of Ireland have very detailed maps. Each page, long page, might only cover 3 or 4 miles. For instance, in the Barrow, up as far as Athy, Athy is the end actually of what they call the Barrow Navigation. After that, you're in the Barrow Line, which is actually a part of the original Grand Canal, built by the merchants from Athy who wanted access to waterways at that time. Merchants from further down, then, for instance, the home place of the Odlum family is St Mullins. And, of course, they were very anxious to get... They had navigation from Waterford up as far as that, but they were very anxious to get to join onto a tie. And that was built, I think, in the late 1770s, 1780s.
Yeah, they were the motorways of their day.
They were the motorways of the day, yes, exactly. But once you get past St Mullins, then your next stop is Greigna Manor, which, of course, is a beautiful small town. And you're entering more open country then from that. You're in and out of valleys and open fields. You get on up to Bagnallstown, Loughlin Bridge, where you're then into the middle of the horsey country. You're along, there are trainers' farms on both sides, and there's galloping horses around. They'd be out that time for the summer, getting a bit of rest from their racing. And it's just the whole place. Further up, you come onto the plains then of the country, where you have the big open fields where they hold the ploughing championships and that. So you have such a variation on that. And all the time, no matter how fast you go, you're going through maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 locks each day. Now, the locks are all manned. if you want help, if you're elderly like I am, you have the mobile phones of the lock keepers. Each lock keeper nowadays looks after 4, 5, or 6 locks, whereas before there was a lock keeper for each lock. There are so few boats using the Barrow now that they're only delighted to see somebody coming, and they will come to St. Mullins, for instance. Paddy comes to St. Mullins and he will stay with me for 5 locks, and he'll have the next lock ready when I get to it, and he'll do all the work on the lock, and I only have to sit there and chat to him, and they do the work. And the upkeep of the locks has been, they have been really since the Good Friday Agreement. The Waterways of Ireland was one of the major things that was agreed between the two, and the Waterways of Ireland are very well looked after on the whole. Once you get to Greig na Mana, you have Greig na Mana is noted all along the approaches to the town. They have carved monks, figures of carved monks, life-size monks, because you have the magnificent abbey there, which I had one of my lifetime experiences there last year. A good friend of one of my sons, who's a farmer come IT specialist, was with me. And I took him into the cathedral there, which is a huge building with, I'd say, the ceilings are 65 or 70 feet high. And he suddenly broke into song, "Nearer, my Lord, to thee." And I can tell you, even still, it catches me.
If I was going to go, say, and rent a canal boat, yes, an inland waterway boat, and spend a week or 10 days going around, where would you recommend?
Well, I mean, you can rent canal boats at Carey's Bridge, which is actually on the Barrow line. It's just above, it's about an hour and a half above Athy, where you join onto the Barrow line from the navigation. And they have 6 or 7 barges there of varying sizes, from the narrow barges to a barge that will sleep 8 or 9 people. I have met people there from Tasmania, who have spent their lives doing the canalways of Europe. And they said that nothing would compare with the River Barrow as regards the beauty, the peace, and the serenity of the surrounding areas and the history. But it's the variation of the countryside. And again, even when you get to the Grand Canal and you head off towards the Shannon, you find yourself going across the Bog of Allen. And the bogs there are absolutely amazing. There are parts of that where you're looking down on the bogs at a lower level than you on both sides, and you're wondering, how the hell did they get the water to stay up inside in this? I believe they had to bring special clay from Italy or somewhere to line the waterways to stop them leaking. And they're literally floating on the bog there. Yeah. So that you have such a variation. And then, of course, you get out into the Shannon. And the Shannon is magnificent waterway, and the facilities are incredible. You'll meet a lot of boats on that. And the entire length of all the waterways, you have beautiful restaurants and old pubs, quaint pubs. Erne Waterway then, I think to 16 locks you have to get from Leitrim over into Upper Lough Erne, and they're all worked on a card system. You have to have somebody goes up into the centre of the lock and inserts a card, and you press buttons, which it's all automatic, but you have to have somebody pressing the buttons. You get out into Lough Erne then, and I mean, Lough Erne is a beautiful, beautiful lake as well. Lots of small islands completely covered in forestation. And very well, the amenities there are terrific. Even in uninhabited islands, they have small marinas with facilities attached, where you can go and you can amble around these uninhabited islands, and you still have the facilities of showers and that there. Enniskillen is for me a magical place. And Devonish Island then above that, again, very historical, a bit like Clonmacnoise, which is a must-see if you're on the Shannon. And right all the way over as far as Beleek, and there's a very aptly named little island there with great hotel and accommodation there called Lusty Beg Island. and the imagination could run rife, because it is a beautiful place and magnificent restaurant, and it would be a place that I would certainly like to go and spend a weekend there sometime.
Thanks to Gerald O'Flynn. And he says that the Barra River is also an absolute paradise for other water users, like canoeists, kayakers, rowing boats of all kinds, as well as swimmers and anglers. The towpaths, he says, are for the most part ideal for walkers and cyclists.